Welcome to the Savvy Shrink Podcast, brought to you by MHNRnetwork.com. I'm your host, Andrea Schneider. I'm a licensed clinical social worker, therapist, and life coach. I will be sharing helpful information for individuals dealing with varying mental health challenges, ranging from trauma and loss to recovering from toxic relationships in love, work, and family, specifically as relates to narcissistic abuse recovery. Other poignant topics will include maternal mental health and special needs parenting, among others. The podcast welcomes guests who share their expertise in trauma-informed and evidence-based interventions, including the latest in neuropsychology. My ebook, Soul Vampires: Reclaiming Your Lifeblood After Narcissistic Abuse, is available at BookBaby and other digital online booksellers. I'm a believer in a strengths-focused perspective for my clients, which harnesses the power of internal wisdom and crafting the inner alchemy of healing. Please grab a cup of coffee or tea, and welcome to The Savvy Shrink. The Savvy Shrink is very honored today to have Claudia Moscovici here. She is the founder of Psychopathy Awareness Blog, which can be found at psychopathyawareness.wordpress.com. She's joining us today to continue the discussion of the prevalence of psychopathy and this covert nature of this form of psychological abuse. Claudia is joining us to share with our listeners her expertise on how the public can be informed and protected from psychopathic and narcissistic abuse. And we talk today about the intersection of this form of abuse in broader settings such as politics and cults and religious institutions. So we're talking about it on a more global level today. Claudia was born in Bucharest, Romania, and by the age of 12, she immigrated with her family to the United States, where she went to obtain a BA from Princeton University and a PhD in comparative literature from Brown University. Moscovici taught philosophy, literature, and arts and ideas at Boston University and at the University of Michigan. Claudia was born in Bucharest, Romania, and she writes from her experience of life in a totalitarian regime, which marked her deeply. She also did some extensive work in 2002 by co-founding with Mexican sculptor Leonardo Perez Nieto the international aesthetic movement called Post-Romanticism, which was devoted to celebrating beauty, passion, and sensuality in contemporary art. She wrote a book on Romanticism and its post-romantic survival called Romanticism and Post-Romanticism in 2007 and taught philosophy, literature, arts and ideas at Boston University and at the University of Michigan. Most recently, she published a nonfiction book on psychopathic seduction called Dangerous Liaisons, published by Hamilton Books in 2011, and a psychological thriller called The Seducer, 2012, which tells the story of a woman lured by a dangerous psychopathic predator. So we're very, very honored to have Claudia Moscovici's expertise, her research, her wisdom as a survivor of psychopathic abuse and also a researcher and writer. Welcome, Claudia. We are so honored to have Claudia Moscovici here today with the Savvy Shrink podcast. Welcome back, Claudia.
Thank you so much. I'm very glad to be back.
We're thrilled to have you. Claudia is the founder of Psychopathy Awareness Blog, and she has come to this podcast today with so much information and wisdom to share. And today we're piggybacking on our first podcast discussion that we did talking about psychopathic seduction. And we talked a lot about psychopathic abuse and malignant narcissistic abuse, and we're going to talk a little bit more about that today too. So thank you again, Claudia, for joining us today.
And thank you for having me back.
You're so welcome. We're thrilled to have you. And so as we were talking about before about narcissistic or psychopathic abuse, these have become pretty popular buzzwords out there online. And what do you think is the most challenging aspect of recovery for survivors? For example, some survivors experience cognitive dissonance. Some have challenges reclaiming self-worth. Some have some PTSD or complex PTSD symptoms. From your perspective, what do you think is the most challenging aspect of recovery?
Well, both malignant narcissists especially and psychopaths create a kind of fake and at first very enticing reality, kind of in the like in the animated film Coraline, where everything you see is better than real. And they have this in common with cults as well, that draw people in with something that seems a better and higher reality.
Yes.
And seems to fulfill all your expectations. I think one of the hardest part of deprogramming once you leave a psychopath or narcissistic relationship is coping with the fact that it was a lie, that it was a facade. It's very, very difficult to believe that you've devoted months, years, some people all their entire lives to something that was just a fake facade and a lie.
Yes. I found that to be the case with the survivors I work with in my practice, that not only is it a loss of a relationship, but it's a loss of the reality you thought existed, even though it didn't. You find out in the aftermath that this person was really faking who they were, and that's part of the betrayal and the deception piece.
Yes, and it's aside from that, that psychological bubble that you were in, that kind of decays little by little. It usually takes a long time for that fake facade and all the lies to kind of be processed.
Yes.
The second thing is, for many people, just like people who have entered cults, because the mentality of psychopaths is very similar, they're isolated often from their friends and family who could have a different perspective on the toxic relationship. Often they're left dependent or without sufficient resources. So the practical aspect of escaping without harm, starting life over from a radical dependency on the psychopath or narcissist is extremely challenging.
How long do you think it takes for survivors to really heal and get that sense of dissipating their cognitive dissonance and really reclaiming their self-worth? That's a question a lot of survivors ask. How long is this going to take?
I just don't think it takes the same amount of time for everyone, because it's so dependent on their personalities and on their resources. People who have not left their jobs and who are not completely isolated and dependent have a much easier time practically. And then the other factor is how susceptible to the brainwashing were they? And when I did have a comment section on psychopathy awareness, I noticed a whole spectrum. People who saw through it and were just thinking through how to escape unharmed. I think those people recover more easily. To people very brainwashed, oscillating back and forth, noticing some of the lies, at the same time saying, I still love him or her.
Right.
I can't, so those would have a much harder time.
Absolutely. And you use the word brainwashing, which I think is spot on. So many survivors report feeling like their brain was really usurped or taken away from them, or some sort of mind control happened in either this romantic relationship or in this toxic connection that they had with somebody at work or in their family. Brainwashing, I think, is a good way to put it, too.
And actually, there's a third factor which touched me and very deeply. And that is how much damage has the psychopath or narcissist induced you to do to others? Cults do that routinely. They make people hurt each other. They make them complicit in the harm. So do these individuals.
Absolutely.
And in my case, I have hurt my husband and my family, and that is something that takes the longest to patch up.
In the aftermath of recovering.
Yes, because it's made you behave immorally. And hurting those closest to you is something, you know, you can eventually separate from the toxic psychopath or narcissist, but you are still enmeshed in your family and friends circle that have suffered because of your actions.
Sure. Sure. And hopefully with compassion and forgiveness, those folks that are in your circle reach a place of moving forward with you and embracing that change in
yes.
terms of
it
healing.
Takes time, but it takes seeing your own role and culpability.
That's a good point. And, you know, you also speak to this kind of behavior as evident in cults. And could you say more about that? Because I know you're writing something about how psychopathic abuse and or narcissistic abuse can sort of be woven into cults.
Well, I think that most people look for something higher than the individual. Many of us just join traditional religions to find that. But for some people, religion may not be the answer, or individualistic and self-affirming, sufficiently self-affirming, especially since Judeo-Christianity is very other regarding. For some individualist persons, writers, actors, artists, their whole lives is devoted to individual creation. So some cults appeal to that seemingly individualist ethic,
right.
And they promise success, achievement, clearing all your flaws or impediments to your success. You know, it's like self-help pumped up on hormones.
Yes.
And that's what individual psychopaths and narcissists do in their kind of seduction phase or idealization phase. For narcissists, they pump you up. They give you everything you thought you've wanted. Beyond just gifts and flattery, they support your career. They seem to validate your personhood, and so do cults.
Right, right.
But then slowly, they isolate you from external influences. They start undermining any aspect of your being that doesn't have to do with them. That is outside the scope of the narcissistic or psychopathic relationship and or the cult group experience. And they get you more and more immersed, more and more involved, until basically you sink into a hole of isolation, and even your mind becomes a prison.
Sounds terrifying. And unfortunately, I think this sort of cultish mentality is almost in vogue in certain circles, like out in Hollywood, and without naming names of some pretty high profile cult type groups. Unfortunately, it seems as though this type of psychological abuse can be woven into these groups that consider themselves to be altruistic or spiritual sort of cults and or religious institutions in some cases.
I've seen, again, a parallel between individual narcissists and psychopaths' behavior and the cults is that they create at least two tiers. One is kind of like the privileged celebrity members, or in the case of an individual narcissist, people they have superficial contact with, who are like the front. They take those people out to dinner, they entertain them, they treat them seemingly well.
Right.
And that is their facade. Narcissists often, for example, seem very generous, giving, they do favors for people, while inside their own intimate relationships, they become tyrants. Similarly, many cults have these two layers. One is the external facade that they treat some people to function as their glitzy, interesting, and attractive facade to others. And then how they treat their inner members is essentially like corporate slaves.
Right. And it's definitely a black hole vortex that can suck people in with that sort of seduction phase. And it doesn't have to be romantic seduction. It can be the leader of this cultish type mentality can sort of observe who the victims, what their vulnerability is, and then claim to be everything that that person needs or wants. Like you had mentioned, some people are very isolated and they're wanting to feel like they're a part of a family, or they're wanting to feel like they're part of a larger cause. And somehow these groups pull people in and prey on their vulnerabilities in easy ways.
And unfortunately, I think that will always happen, you know, whether one cult goes out of existence or not. These kinds of dangerous attractions will occur, because most of our lives it is routine, and it's easy to take your family or job for granted day in and day out.
Right.
All of us have some attraction to excitement and novelty and higher meaning.
Yes. And if that cult or person, if they're a psychopathic or highly narcissistic person, can pretend to offer those things that the person is wanting, then it can be a real draw for that person. So that's truly a red flag. And I definitely want to talk more about that. But I'm wondering, for our listeners, can you share a little bit about how a malignant narcissist is different than a psychopath? How are they different? How are they the same? And how would it look differently as an individual versus like a cult type of a person, so people could be aware of the red flags?
Well, one of the best explanations of this distinction is offered by Steve Becker, who was then writing for the Donna Anderson's Love Fraud blog.
Great.
And he said all psychopaths have narcissistic traits. At core, it is all about them, even when they seem to be other regarding. But not all narcissists are psychopathic. It seems like psychopaths have a much more game-like mentality, whereas malignant narcissists actually tend to be more unhappy people, constantly concerned with their image, constantly going out after others, not as a game, you know, like predator and prey, but more like anybody who says anything slightly negative about them, be it the media itself or an individual, they do launch a horrible smear campaign. And any kind of source of information that isn't laudatory, well, that's fake news. That's false.
Yeah.
So they're malignant narcissists are often unhappy people.
Yeah.
Concerned with their image to the point where it causes their own misery, not just those of others.
Okay. Yeah. Whereas like a psychopath is not even connected even with their own misery, it sounds like, in the sense that
they're so shallow.
Yeah, they're very shallow.
Yeah. That even emotions, like they may have enough anger to kill their spouse in a fit of rage, but 3 minutes later, they can be partying with a friend or buying a pizza because their emotions are so shallow that they're very fleeting.
Yes, and they can flip that switch very easily. And so, you know, and I work with a lot of people that feel that they've been harmed by either a malignant narcissist or a psychopath, and they want to know, well, what is the diagnosis of this person? And of course, I can't diagnose somebody who's not in my practice or who I'm not providing therapy for, but the constellation of symptoms and traits that are described often does seem to fall under, you know, when the psychological abuser being a malignant narcissist or a psychopath, not always, but it's often the case. It certainly falls on that axis to categorization, which I suppose would go under antisocial personality disorder for the psychopath. But with a malignant narcissist, maybe more extreme NPD. And of course, with the DSM-5, now all these classifications are changing as well. And ultimately, I suppose that the label of the abuser doesn't necessarily matter per se, except that the survivor needs to understand there's a specific form of psychological abuse that is incredibly covert and deceptive, that is often deployed by either malignant narcissists or psychopaths. And so that's why.
One of the most, even if it's difficult to diagnose the exact difference between a malignant narcissist and a sociopath, they're so close in the spectrum.
Sure.
What's most relevant to people is a distinction between mental illness and pathology.
Yes.
I think that, you know, psychopathy, narcissism, borderline personality disorder are not mental illnesses. They are not treatable through therapy or drugs. They are, it's a deficiency of proper emotions that people develop or are born with, and nobody can, you know, do an emotion transplant in their brains.
Right.
Whereas the mental illnesses can be treated.
Yes. Like depression, anxiety, that can be acute and time limited, and it's not related per se to someone's personality. It's more a fleeting circumstance. Sometimes it's biochemical in nature or hormonally induced per se, or maybe a stressful life event like a trauma or a loss. Whereas somebody that's got extreme narcissistic traits or psychopathy is, we're looking at an ingrained pervasive pattern of personality characteristics that have been there from day one with the individual and have magnified potentially over time. And so when we work with survivors that are recovering in the aftermath of psychological abuse by a malignant narcissist or a psychopath, would you say recovery is, it takes a similar pathway depending upon the type of abuser, or does it really matter what the label of the abuser is?
I think it does take a similar path. Mm-hmm. I think that malignant narcissists tend to be less likable people because they get so bitter about any attack on their awesomeness. And with psychopaths, it's more like a constant merry-go-round. I think, and they can put on the charm much more readily than malignant narcissists, so they can blind the person again or reseduce the same individual.
So they're more potentially deceptive. A psychopath could be more deceptive. And and where's the malignant
narcissist? Can go back to being, if it's a man, Prince Charming, or, you know, it's like that. Everything glosses off their backs in the long term. So they can try to have the same conquest over and over. They don't give up. Whereas with a malignant narcissist, often after you've been de-idealized, all you see is their sour face and how you're on their shit list.
And you stay there, usually. But with somebody who's a psychopath, they're glib and they're very superficial, as you mentioned before, and can be like a chameleon and very slippery and slide back into whatever character they are pretending to be to feed their ego or fuel them. And I think too, I've also found working with clients that are recovering from psychological abuse by either a malignant narcissist or a psychopath, they find that the type of narcissistic supply that such an abuser is trying to extract tends to be pretty sadistic. So in other words, a survivor who's being abused by a garden variety narcissist, that narcissistic supply might come in the form of providing attention, adulation, appreciation to a narcissist. Whereas with somebody who's further on the spectrum, like a malignant narcissist or a psychopath, and I say spectrum of narcissism, that type of ego fuel tends to generate a negative response from the survivor. For example, if a malignant narcissist or psychopath wants narcissistic or psychopathic supply, they're going to try to get a reaction out of their target that induces hurt and harm and pain and suffering. For example, maybe they verbally put down the individual, or they, or in some cases, they might physically abuse the individual. But it seems to take on more of a sadistic sort of form of narcissistic supply, in my experience anyway. And I think a lot of folks really just want to know how they can avoid people like this, because the reality is we don't go through life thinking we're going to encounter a malignant narcissist or a psychopath. We don't really go to school in elementary school even knowing what these people are, and that they are dangerous folks that can exist in love, work, and family, in politics, in religious institutions, all over the place. So I guess one of my huge questions is, how do we help people to become informed and aware of these types of folks, and how to avoid these toxic interactions with people like this? And I think you're an ideal person to ask that question to, since you are the founder of Psychopathy Awareness Blog, which is an incredibly helpful, informative website for people to really learn more. Yeah.
Aside from spreading information through websites like Love Fraud, Psychopathy Awareness, Psychopath Free, especially Robert Hare's work, on which all of this is based, I think that mental health professionals have to take the lead more, because one tendency I've noticed is that obviously they're incentivized to deal with curable mental illnesses, whether neurotic disorders like anxiety or OCD, or mental illnesses that can be ameliorated through therapy and medication. They don't broach as routinely personality disorders, because personality disorders, there's not much they can do about it. So the field has kind of avoided that subject, and it's been taken over by a few experts like Robert Hare, and mostly self-help websites like Love Fraud and Psychopathy Awareness.
Sure.
And I would it would be wonderful if mental health professionals would make it part of their routine testing, or, you know, to indicate to people, your spouse has a personality disorder, or might have, and look out for these traits.
Yeah.
As opposed to just working on the usual methods of regressive therapy, couples counseling, the methods that work for neurotic disorders and mental illness, or just regular crises, but they do not work for personality disorders.
Exactly. I think that's good advice. And certainly it would be contraindicated to do couples work with somebody who is a malignant narcissist or psychopath. And so I would never recommend couples counseling to a survivor that is in a relationship with somebody that has such severe characteristics. And I would definitely work with that individual to provide support for them and really trauma-informed care to help them to heal in the aftermath of being exposed to someone like that, which is what I do in my own practice. And it is alarming that malignant narcissists and psychopaths do exist in all spheres of life. So, you know, you could encounter somebody that is in a romantic relationship, in a work environment, in a family of origin type scenario. So I agree with you. I think the field of psychology and therapists really need to do a better job, not only of educating themselves about this, but then also providing more psychoeducation for their clients as well. I think that would go a long way. And certainly,
in my case,
go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to give one example. Is that in my case, I first learned about psychopathy on Love Fraud. I started reading Robert Hare and Martha Stout and others. And I went to my therapist informed. And I think that's what helped me.
Yes.
Kind of channel the discussion towards that.
Right.
And so I think since the mental health profession is still geared towards fixable psychological disorders, people have to, these websites are useful because people find out about what they need to talk about.
Exactly.
Even if the therapist doesn't bring it up first.
Good. I think that's a great advice for our listeners, for sure. Because some therapists actually are not trained in knowing what to look for. So it does go back to psychoeducation for not only therapists, but also clients. And psychoeducation is really so vital in the healing journey. And I think it does lower cognitive dissonance. It allows survivors to narrate their story, which is the truth, because so often wrapped up in this psychological abuse is a lot of pathological lying on behalf of the psychopath or the malignant narcissist. So, websites such as yours, the Psychopathy Awareness Blog, and others like Love Fraud, are chock full of information that are incredibly helpful. Education is a key piece of the puzzle. So we really appreciate your contributions to the field. Yes. And on that subject, it seems as though recent events politically and in the news have finally put malignant narcissism on the map for the layperson. The word narcissist is suddenly common vernacular through recent political events, I would say. Can you say more about that? And can you share your observations about that?
Yeah, in this case, I guess I will be specific.
Okay.
I really don't have strong political partisan leanings.
Uh-huh.
In fact, during the election, I admire Kasich, although generally speaking, I'm a Democrat and in the end voted for Clinton. But so I don't have, if I like the individual agenda.
Sure.
However, I think that Donald Trump exhibits the characteristics of malignant narcissism.
Yes.
This demonization of the media, mm-hmm. everything but primarily Sean Hannity's show, because he's the most sycophantish of the newscasters towards Trump.
Yes.
But Fox News in general, and the fact that even when he gets daily reports about national and international events, he tends to just read his name. Like, he has no patience about reading mm-hmm. everything and becoming informed.
Right.
The fact that he goes after, as he exhibited in the Republican primaries, goes after political rivals as mm-hmm. enemies and maligns them.
Mm-hmm.
And insults them, almost, it seems, almost mean adolescent behavior, but it's absolutely classic malignant narcissist tactics for adults.
Yes. It's like a smear campaign, it seems like.
The smear campaign.
Yeah.
It is just, and the grandiosity, the nonstop grandiosity.
Right.
And yet, the vulnerability to external attack, he cares deeply about external attacks and goes after it aggressively.
He gets narcissistic injuries so easily if someone attacks him, it seems, and then he responds with his Twitter account, unfortunately, and seems to blast people that way very impulsively, which...
Yeah, and it's scary that, you know, the common person can identify him with him. Mm. I mean, he's made it acceptable to be sexually abusive to women.
So disturbing.
With it's so the pussy grabbing incident. He's made it acceptable to be bigoted towards foreigners.
Right.
And wants to build, like, he's getting our worst nationalist impulses and distorting them in a way that will have lasting negative effect.
It's very disturbing that this individual who seems to be causing more harm than good could be elected in this nation that supposedly represents liberty and freedom. And, you know, I'll go on record for saying that I am a progressive Democrat, so I am biased in my opinion politically, but I definitely have concern about the personality characteristics of the current president. And I still have a hard time even saying who the president is. I'm still in shock that he's the president because
I am too.
Yeah.
One thing I have to say, however, is that I'm more worried about the direction of the Republican Party than I am. I mean, definitely Trump is setting authoritarian precedents that are dangerous for the long term for democracy.
Say more
but
about
the
that.
Fact,
yeah.
The fact that he wants to censor the news, the fact that he's constantly shuffling his cabinet, not letting anybody consolidate power properly, except maybe his own dynasty, his daughter and son-in-law. It just he's the fact that he lies so readily and colludes with Russia. It's I don't know if he has been directly involved in treasonous acts. I know the Mueller investigation has uncovered those around him were. And what's worrisome is that in order to maintain power, people like Paul Ryan and the Republican Party in overall, for the most part, is going along with these authoritarian agendas. For it's like they're a football team and this is our team as opposed to our country.
Exactly. It feels like it's enabling this level of unsafety to continue. There's no system of checks and balances. And this isn't just, you know, people that are Democrats or whatever upset because there's a Republican in office and in Congress. No, it's not that at all. It's the individual that's in office has very disturbing patterns of behavior that do not create a sense of safety at all, and that it's being enabled by the people in Congress. There's no system of checks and balances. And and I think you're an excellent person to speak to this because you've written extensively about totalitarian regimes, and you can see the danger of where our country is at currently.
Well, I see similarities. I mean, Nicolae and Elena Ceausescu were basically average intelligence, uneducated people. Now, Trump did get a degree at Wharton, but I wouldn't call him educated. He does not read. He doesn't inform himself. He just has a degree. But they would collect all these fake degrees and honors and surround themselves with sycophants that, aside from members of their family, they constantly shuffled and engaged in similar behavior. But that in itself would not be as dangerous if the Republican Party would, who did not initially endorse Trump. I think they recognized him as a narcissistic person unqualified for the job. Politically unqualified. Still, once they reconciled themselves and saw that he could get them elected or stay elected, it's just a team mentality. Similar to authoritarian societies. So the whole Republican Party is aggravating the tendencies of towards authoritarianism in their behavior.
You're right. I believe that to be the case as well. And I think you're also spot on when you say, you know, the fake news, like the Fox News type program, seems to fuel lies and total propaganda, you know. And sure, there are some channels that are more biased towards liberal or progressives, etc. But correct me if I'm wrong, I don't see fake news in those channels. It might be slanted in a direction, whereas, you know, it's really concerning when there is absolutely lies on some channels.
Now, on Fox, what I have noticed is it's rare that they themselves say false things, but what they do is they quote people who say false things, like the Trump administration constantly lies about things, and they have their figureheads and spokespeople talk. And the second thing is their lies are mostly what they choose to focus on and how they withhold information that would support the opposite point of view or a different point of view. So it's more for Fox News, the selection. And I'm not against the fact that Fox News exists because, you know, for the same reason Rush Limbaugh has a right to exist for conservatives. But no news station, no matter what political spectrum they're on, should have no fact checking of the people they interview.
Exactly.
There should be standards of truth.
Yes,
not just,
I agree.
Not even when there is bias, you yes. should verify the information.
Absolutely, because a lot of people don't critically analyze the information or the source of information that they get. And maybe they're getting something on their news feed on Facebook or something along those lines. And maybe they subscribe to a certain news channel. So if that news channel hasn't fact checked the information, then fake news is spread out. And that is a form
exactly.
of, yeah, it's a form of gaslighting. So it's, and then it happens on a political level. So, and then there we are replicating huge mistakes of the past that I can't believe we're in the year 2018 and we're dealing with this because it sure seems to echo some prior political circumstances that I believe you might be writing about as well regarding the Holocaust, correct?
Yes. What I'm interested in is how such narcissistic or psychopathic behavior can spread and become mainstream mm-hmm. in authoritarian regimes to people who aren't otherwise disordered.
Yeah, yeah. It is concerning that so many people can fall prey to fake news and actually believe that information and support these types of individuals in power. And again, it feels so concerning because there is not a system of checks and balances currently. It's very unbalanced,
yes.
I suppose.
And I have to say, I saw it on the other end of the spectrum when I was an academic.
Mm.
The reason I left the academia is in my field, literary studies, mm-hmm. for French, they had this newspeak informed by postmodernism, post-structuralism, Jacques Lacan, and a newspeak with a kind of extreme political radicalism.
Mm.
And I felt it was similarly a form of mind control.
Yeah.
So it's not just the right.
You're right.
And,
and
in fact, Trump uses this.
Uh-huh.
He uses the term political correctness
mm-hmm.
way too broadly to refer to anybody who supports women's rights, equal treatment for women, human rights even.
Exactly.
But at the same time, the political correctness does exist in certain spheres.
Mm-hmm.
I saw it with my own eyes, and it was unbearable.
Yes, yes. Thank you so much, Claudia, for being with us today. Our listeners have been gifted with your wisdom and knowledge, and for further study and information, please find Claudia's information on psychopathyawareness.wordpress.com. That's the Psychopathy Awareness blog that is online. Also, you can find her works as relates to psychopathic abuse, as mentioned in the introduction. Firstly, her nonfiction book on psychopathic seduction called Dangerous Liaisons, published in 2011. And then a fiction psychological thriller called The Seducer, published in 2012. So again, thank you, Claudia, and thank you, listeners, for joining us today on The Savvy Shrink.
Thank you again for listening to The Savvy Shrink. For more information about this podcast, go to thesavvyshrink.com or visit my website at andreaschneiderlcsw.com. This is your host, Andrea Schneider. Until next time. Thank you.